And Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling A23-1177 in the matter of the welfare of AAS child.
Okay, good morning. And this is our third case on our calendar today, February 29th. And councils, as you probably know, you each have 15 minutes for your argument. There will be an additional 5 minutes for appellant's counsel to give rebuttal. There's a clock on the podium, and that'll show you what your time is. It seems you are familiar with how to adjust the podium, so feel free to do that when you each stand up and are ready. If you could just make sure to introduce yourself and identify your client when you start for our record. We are recording these arguments. There will be an audio recording available on the branch's website within about 24 hours. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Melissa Haley. I am the counsel for appellant, the child AAS. This is an appeal out of the Rice County District Court of the child's adjudication for obstructing legal process. There are two main issues on appeal. Both relate to statutory interpretation. One is the application of the obstructing statute, subdivision 1-1, the lawful execution of legal process to the physical conduct in this case. And the second is the intersection of that statute and the facts in the record on a sufficiency challenge. Since both of those issues involve legal determination by this court, the standard of review is de novo review. Turning to the facts of this case, they're really not in dispute. They're pretty straightforward. By way of background,
Can I clarify, counsel, before you move on, that last statement you made, the standard of review, would that not only apply if there was a legal dispute on the meaning of the terms? I understood from your brief it was more of a sufficiency, whether the conduct, standard sufficiency review, whether the conduct of your client on this day in question fits the definition. It's not in dispute. It's just a dispute as to whether it fits it. In other words, whether his conduct hindered, interfered, and the other adjectives that are described. Is it more that than a dispute on what those words mean? Which then would be a de novo. That instead, it seems like it's just it's a review of the direct evidence and the standard we'd apply to whether it was sufficient to apply to those that meaning.
Right. No, I definitely appreciate the opportunity to clarify. Our position is that it's not a straight sufficiency, just a factual review. It is in the context of that statute. It's looking at the applicability of that, whether or not, and in that case, it might be easier to address that in talking about State versus Peterson that raised that issue, looked at that issue, and talks about whether that you need to look at the specific duty that the officers were involved in. So you do have to look at the application of the statute to the facts and determine what that statute meant. So that's why it's de novo on that issue. On the sufficiency issue, the second issue, we're actually asking you to find that lawful in the text of that statute is an element of the offense that the state had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So we do need statutory interpretation to determine how that statute intersects with the burden of proof and not just a straight sufficiency where you're saying, do these facts meet the statute? I hope that answered the question.
Well, I appreciate the answer. I'm not fully yet on board with understanding it. I'll just say from my own standpoint, because as I look at the arguments in the brief, it looked to me like, and the case law that you're citing, and that's why you contrast it with some cases, in fact, earlier cases when the earlier obstructing had the oral fighting words language, but it all kind of kept coming back to what we're more used to reviewing, is that these facts just don't fit those words, therefore it's insufficient. And that's as opposed to the words themselves. My main reason is I didn't think that anybody was arguing that what hindering or interfering means, just that your point is and the respondent disagrees that these facts don't equate to that, which then kind of comes back factually to the to our sufficiency, at least normally.
I think that the facts in this case, the physical conduct, happened after the warrant, which is what they're arguing is a legal process, already happened. And the only provision of obstructing that was charged was the first one. And so that duty already happened. The conduct is later. And so could this have been a crime under a different theory, even under the second theory of the obstructing statute, provision 1-2, where it's general performance of police duties? Perhaps. But our legal argument is you're looking at that section that was charged, it's not the type of duty that we're talking about in this case. And it's very similar to Peterson. Peterson, it was investigating domestic assault. So that was the duty that they were operating under. Here, they're operating under investigating a noise complaint initially. In Peterson, the physical conduct that occurred was probably the level of substantial interference, which was blocking the door from the police officer, ending up in a direct engagement with a police officer where they kicked the police officer in the head, and the police officer sustained injuries. And in that case, they made a legal determination that that regardless of the conduct, the focus should be on the duties that the police were executing, and that they were executing things in their normal performance of duties, but not the duties specifically dealt with in the statute that the state elected to charge, which was the lawful execution of legal process.
Wasn't the issue there, though, and the reason obstructing to fit is because the assault happened. That was the physical, and that was the charge, assault against the officer, which arguably becomes an obstruction, but that's the point you're making after the fact. But I'm not sure I follow, though, your correlation of that to our case when you say the physical contact here after the fact wasn't the allegation here. The actual physical contact was the crime. In other words, his interference, his lunging in while they're attempting to arrest his father.
So the point, I'm going to jump to the kind of the general sufficiency argument and the need for the lawful to be an element in the case, because in that context and in that section of the brief, we talk about some of the rules around executing the warrant, and under Rule 3, a warrant is executed upon arrest. And so the point that I was trying to make is that Scott was clearly under arrest when he was handcuffed and already pinned to the side of the truck when the physical conduct occurred. So physical conduct that occurs after the execution of the legal process isn't interfering with the execution of the legal process. And I appreciate it. I think maybe I've finally been able to articulate what I mean.
your point being is you can't obstruct a legal process that's already occurred and done.
It's already occurred and done.
But
and
let me ask you this, though. As I looked at the video, it seems like it was all at the same time. In other words, from the beginning of this interaction with his father, he said there's going to be a problem. I can't remember the phrase he used. It sounded like a threat. And then he followed up with it. He kept coming in, and then the female officer kind of was pushing him, and he'd do it again and pushing him. And they're in the process of holding him against the car because he's also tensing up and kind of resisting, you might say, but he was in the process. And then it's during that when your client then also lunges in, and that's when they really got serious to push him away and down on the ground. So from my view of that, why am I wrong to suggest it was all happening at the same time, which it was at a minimum seemed to be interfering is a good, perhaps the best adjective of those options under that parentheses one option. I mean, he certainly didn't stand back and watch and say you're doing a good job or just verbalize why he was upset, but he actually physically got in the middle. Isn't that exactly what an interference is? Or is your point, that's why I was leading into it, it looked to me it was all at once. You're suggesting all the legal requirements of the officer were complete when he dove in.
That is what I'm suggesting. And also note here, you're talking about some of the verbal frustration or the things that the child was saying during the interaction prior to reaching into his father's waistband. And interestingly, the respondent in his brief tries to distinguish all the cases that I'm talking about, saying, but that those are verbal. They're talking about verbal, and we're talking about physical obstruction here. And I suspect one of the reasons for them to do that is that verbal by itself can be annoying, it can be interfering, not legally, but, you know, causing the officers have to say something to tell them to get back, that type of a thing. All of that was not, that wouldn't, even if it was the lead up to what he was doing, or even if he intended, even if you decide that's enough, that this kid intended to interfere when he put his hand into the waistband. Our position is that's still not enough under the statute, because the elements of the crime charged, and this is CrimJig 29.39 and not the one referenced in the respondent's brief, you have to prove the lawful execution of legal process. So they got to prove that there was a legal process. That goes to the issue of the warrant. We still don't know what it is, that type of thing. That lawfulness, I talked a lot about in my brief. I won't belabor that here, but it's essentially the burden to prove that is on the state. It's not on us to disprove an element of this offense. We can't. We still have never seen a warrant. A warrant, you can tell from the transcript, was not provided. The lawyer references it in closing argument. He still hasn't seen any of that.
Did you cite any law that would require, in this circumstance, that law enforcement present to a third party, who's the future prospective obstructor, evidence or physical presence of the warrant or somehow proof that it's a valid warrant? The reason I'm asking that is there are circumstances where an arrestee might have a claim regarding a warrant, if it's an illegal warrant or an improper warrant, but how about a third party who's obstructing? What law would you cite?
I don't know that I can point to a third party having a right to that.
Isn't that though your claim? Because your client is the third party here, and
right. But what
and
I was
you're making the point they haven't proven there's a warrant, but yet the district court was satisfied that through the questioning of the dispatch system, the computer system that showed there was a warrant, and it was visit for him once they confirmed his name.
That's correct. And what we're saying is that the district court erred because they essentially, the only thing the officer said was there was a warrant. After reviewing the officer's report, which there's data requirements, they should be including everything they know in their report, and the video, the officer was only able to say, I don't recall anything about it, right? I don't know anything about the warrant. I don't know if it's civil. I don't know if it's criminal. I don't know if...
But that's why I'm asking, though, what more would he need to know for proving, in this case, that they're lawfully arresting him because he testified the basis of learning there's a warrant.
So let me take it a bigger picture. The judge didn't have the warrant. The judge had to just decide this person says that this was lawful. The police officer says this lawful. There's no other checks that we normally have on whether or not something's lawful. So, but in this case, this was lawful. The defense, but big picture wise, that essentially shifts the burden to the defense to prove that it wasn't lawful if they just assume that it was, right?
But
the defense doesn't have the benefit of discovery on any of this, and so they can't do anything other than they did, which is make a motion for judgment of acquittal because it's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt that it's a lawful warrant. I realize
we're kind of
talking in circles a little bit, but
I'm just trying to fully understand, but would you agree that even an unlawful arrest would not be a legal basis for a third party to interfere? That's kind of what I'm getting at, is that's why I asked at the beginning question on this topic, is what benefit does your client get from an illegal arrest to his dad, if it's illegal, even if it's illegal? For the obstructing, you just need to know that the officers aren't arresting someone without a warrant for no reason. That might then be a no legal process, but here they had a warrant, testified to the warrant, and that was the basis.
So in answer to your questions about the cases on no right to arrest, I don't think that's applicable here. We're talking about whether or not the state proved lawfulness. That's different than where we see the no right to challenge the arrest if for the dad, right? Or in the context of Fourth Amendment. And the cases cited in the respondent's brief were before the obstructing statute was split in 1989 after Krosky, and the courts have since really hammered on this idea that you need to look at the conduct, the duties that the police were performing, and then the conduct, and not start with the idea that this person interfered. You got to start with what were they doing, what were the duties, did the state prove the lawfulness of, in this case, the very specific duty, which was the lawful execution of legal process. And if you don't find that they proved all of those things beyond a reasonable doubt, which I don't think there is on this record, then we're asking that this adjudication be reversed. I'll leave it at that. I'm out of time. Thank you.
May I ask
a
question?
Please do.
I have a question for you, if I may, before you sit down. I just want to make sure I'm understanding your argument here with your exchange with Judge Sleater. So it seems to me you're making a distinction of what happened in real time with where they were arresting his dad. And a third party doesn't have a right to necessarily intervene in that. But distinction for what's happening in real time versus the trial of the child here, which is here is what you have to prove for that. And what you have to prove for that is a lawful warrant in order to obtain the conviction for the child. Is that right?
That is absolutely right.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I was clear on that. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. So we'll hear next from counsel for respondent. There are 15 minutes on the clock. You feel free to adjust the podium and then begin when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sean McCarthy. I'm an assistant Rice County attorney. I appear today on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. I'd like to pick up right where Judge Schmidt finished. The sufficiency or the element of a lawful arrest does not require that we mark and offer a particular piece of paper as an exhibit at trial. It requires that there be some evidence that the judge or the finder of fact hears and evaluates. This judge heard two different officers testify. They got a complaint about some noise in an unlicensed trailer. They're driving to this particular residence. One of the officers specifically testified, Officer Milne specifically testified, that he was familiar with this residence, knew who lived there, and was pretty sure that the father had a warrant. He then further testified that he checked on his squad computer, which is connected to the NCIC, to the jail, to the overall criminal justice system records, and confirmed there was a valid court issued. This is the part that counsel kind of missed there. This was a judge-issued warrant. It's not for the officer then to stop everything and say, I wonder if that warrant's valid. This is a court order to arrest somebody. That arrest warrant and the testimony by the officers, both officers, about the existence of the arrest warrant is something that the trial court found credible. That's a sufficient basis under Minnesota law. To take appellant's argument to its logical extreme would be creating some kind of new burden of proof, some new duty to prove more than just testimony of officers in a case. And as you all know, officer testimony is the primary way by which we get most of our criminal evidence into just district court in the first place. If we're going to start adding new pieces onto it, that seems like that's really more a question for the legislature, and there's no, you know, constitutional ground to support it here. And it all goes back to what Judge Sleater said at the beginning. This is not a de novo case. This is not a statutory interpretation case. This is a straightforward sufficiency of the evidence. And the two arguments that counsel focuses most exclusively on, that appellants really focused on, are the sufficiency or the lawfulness of the warrant, and secondly, this issue of intent. What did the appellant intend or not when he was making his statements, making his movements, refusing to answer to the officer's request that he stand down, and continuing to step in between them and grab at his father's waistband? It's not any one little piece of that. It's all of that. I point that, as Judge Sleater referenced, the video is only 2 minutes and 37 seconds. If you have any questions, any doubts, and if you haven't had a chance to review it, or if any of your staff attorneys haven't had a chance to review it, take the 2 minutes and 37 seconds, and you will see exactly what Judge Sleater referenced. This was a fluid situation. It's all happening kind of at the same time. And contrary to appellant's attempt to parse this case into, oh, the arrest was done, the warrant had been served, this is an arrest that was still in process. You can see on Exhibit 1, Dad is struggling, his arms are moving, the officers are struggling with him. The son, the appellant in this case, not only has some verbal statements, but he keeps coming forward, and one of the officers has to stop. She's trying to restrain the father's arm. She stops, and you see her push him back. He's physically coming forward at just after he's made his statements that you're going to have a problem with this, or problem with me. Then he comes forward, and she has to push him back. She has to stop what she's doing, which is attempting to arrest the dad. She stops that to deal with him, and yet appellant continues to come forward. And again, it happens very fluidly, but the thought that the arrest was done, that the warrant was over with, this is a person who was still in the process of being cuffed, restrained, pat down, searched, and then placed in a secure place, placed in the squad car.
How would you contrast this? How do you? It looked to me, too, from that video that notwithstanding the interference, I mean, he was doing that, they were going to be arresting his dad no matter what, and it was going to happen.
Yes.
And why does that not at least bring some comparison to the case law that does the predate the oral? We know the conduct that's irritating, frustrating, you know, all of that is not a basis for obstructing, because you have to have a thick skin in this business. So in the end, because they were going to arrest him anyway, isn't that a lot of what was happening here?
I think I understand the court's question, I would agree. This does seem to be that they're going to arrest because they're following a lawful court order. And in terms of lawfulness here, it's not for the officer to decide right then and there, is this judge's order lawful? It's just, is there an order showing up in my system where a judge has said, arrest this person? There's no analysis of that at that point. That analysis can come afterwards during father's case about whether or not he was lawfully arrested. That can come into Fourth Amendment stuff later on. But in this case, he was going to be arrested. And that's not a justification for the son, the third party, to physically get in the middle of it, step between the officers. And it actually pulled one of the officers, had to come away from the process of restraining the father to deal with the son. Does that answer the court's question?
It does. I appreciate that. I actually want to follow up a hypothetical following up Judge Schmidt's question. Let's assume...
Judge Sleater, I've never seen you use a hypothetical. This is shocking.
Maybe never a real good one, but I'll try.
Sorry.
Let's assume that it's not a warrant, but they have probable cause to believe he's committed a crime, therefore a felony crime, therefore they arrest him. Now, at that point, the point of the answer of appellant's counsel is that... That's separate from now the proof at trial, the legality. What if between the arrest and now the trial, there was a constitutional violation, probable cause, crime dismissed, the charge dismissed? What is your position on the proof on the day of trial after the dismissal of that, because the arrest was illegal?
Your Honor, with all due respect, I have not thought of that scenario.
I only thought of it now because it was an excellent question, and it does kind of go, if I understand the appellant's point.
It does, and my take on it would be the following, that if what the officers were doing at the time We're almost getting into a good faith of Fourth Amendment kind of analysis on this, which I don't think applies to this case, but I want to answer the court's question. If what the officers were doing at the time was something that there was a court order for a valid arrest, and they are executing that court order, that's the service of process, or that's the execution of process, or the arrest of a person in connection with the execution of that process. So under the obstruction statute, under 609.50, that would be sufficient for those purposes. If it turned out later on that that process was not lawful, I will acknowledge there might be a legal argument that would be a different case to address on the obstruction charge itself, because then we'd kind of be getting into, was the element proved or not? I will concede that much of it. Unfortunately, that's not this case. Right now we have speculation that there might possibly not have been a valid warrant. That speculation is insufficient. The trial court gets deference here. Again, this is not a de novo case. It's a sufficiency of the evidence case. Is the testimony by the two officers, specifically the testimony at transcript page 55, this is your note-taking moment for your staff attorneys, and the trial court's finding of fact number 2. The trial court found the officers, their testimony, credible that this was that there was an active, valid arrest warrant for the father. Is that sufficient on these facts? That testimony by the officers, the judge giving credit to that, this is not a statutory interpretation issue. This is that a sufficient basis for the trial court to make a credibility determination and to rely on that as it applies the facts to the law? The respondent's position is that it does. So, Your Honor, what I'm trying to do is acknowledge, I think that your question is an interesting question. I don't think it's this case. But that interesting question, there may very well be a scenario where if the thing you were trying to arrest the person for were not valid or found to be unlawful for some constitutional violation of some sorts, I could envision there'd be room to argue about that. But it's so speculative and so far away, even in the form of the hypothetical, that it's hard to make it fit the facts of this case.
And where we have the initial response, though, too, I think, was there's not a separation. In other words, at the time of the arrest, there was a warrant, which that too could have been quashed, might be quashed later on, or maybe it was an illegal warrant, we don't know, or a clerical mistake. But your point in answer to that, though, is as of that moment, the court found credible that they had a warrant, they had good information, it was a warrant, and that's what their process was on that.
Exactly. And from a burden of proof standpoint, the testimony of the officers is a sufficient basis for the trial court to believe the officers and say, I believe that your computer said this was a valid active warrant, and that's good enough for me. You were executing an arrest warrant, and by executing an arrest warrant, that's lawful process.
I just want to double check on your, I didn't see a specific credibility determination. I mean, I'm looking at respondents' addendum, page 1, finding of fact 2, where they recited the officer's testimony. Now, necessarily, the court ended up finding that there was a valid warrant, and so did give credit to that testimony. But there's no specific credibility determination that I see, anyway.
Your Honor, I would suggest that finding of fact 2 should be read together with the oral determination made at transcript page 55. And for the court's consideration, this is page 4 of respondent's brief. I put a block quote about a little more than halfway down the page. The trial court specifically said the officers testified, they verified that the father had a warrant for him. They were acting upon that warrant. And then the court makes a couple of comments and goes on to say they were performing a legal obligation of following with the court-ordered warrant and taking Mr. Sandberg under arrest. What I'm getting at there is if you take that together with finding of fact number 2, clearly the trial court is saying, I just heard these two officers testify that here's what they were doing, and I specifically find that's what they were doing. It is at a minimum an implicit factual finding of credibility. I would argue that when you look at the transcript of what the court said orally on the record during the trial, right after hearing the testimony, it's a pretty explicit credibility finding. He wasn't saying, oh, there's possibly something that was illegal here. He's saying, no, I believe him, and I find that they were executing lawful process. Does that help guide the court towards the record that you were asking about?
Yes, yeah. I was just, you had mentioned finding of fact number two and that the judge found that credible, and there's, I mean.
He didn't say in writing that he found it credible.
Right.
But if you take what he said on the record together with what he wrote in his findings, I would argue that's a pretty strong credibility finding. Does that answer the court's question?
It does, yeah, thank you.
Unless there are additional questions, what the state would suggest here is, from respondent's perspective, the cases that appellant relies upon to try to argue this is a de novo standard review and to try to carve this case out, and referencing Peterson, for example, is one of the cases that appellant cited in their presentation, those cases that really are the outer limits of obstruction law, they're the cases where, gee, what does the word blighted mean in the context of a junk car when you've got the word blighted in a city ordinance? Is this a blight kind of circumstance? Well, that's interpreting what does the word mean, right? So that's a de novo standard of review. Likewise, Peterson, the Peterson case, P-E-D-E-R-S-O-N, Peterson is a case where there was not an arrest. It was investigating whether a domestic assault had occurred or not. It's kind of a welfare check kind of scenario. There's no lawful process in Peterson. Therefore, Peterson really wasn't the execution of lawful process. It's officers there investigating something, kind of checking on the well-being of a particular family. But that's different than our case. We have a trial court credibility finding or trial court factual finding at a minimum that the officers were executing lawful process. There's nothing to say that's clearly erroneous on this record. And in fact, this court should give deference to the trial court's factual determinations and the fact finder's ultimate findings in this case and view the evidence in the consistency of the verdict. In light of that, Your Honors, the respondent would submit that this is a decision that is well supported by the record. It requires a sufficiency of the evidence style review, not a de novo review, because there is no legal analysis of words in the statute. And lastly, that sufficiency evidence is well supported and this court should affirm. Unless there are further questions.
I do have one more question. Subdivision 1-2 about obstructs, resists, or interferes with a police officer in their performance of official duties, that's not before us, right? That's not a... You could have charged that, you didn't, so we're only looking at subdivision one.
Right, I believe it was charged as sub one. I'm fairly certain it was also referenced as 2-3, but that might be the punishment portion of it. I don't think that that's the substantive charge.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So we will have 5 minutes on the clock for rebuttal, and take your time, and when you're ready, counsel, you may begin.
I want to start with clarifying that subdivision 1-1 was the only one charged, and in fact, the complaint or the citation was amended a few times, so there were ample times to add the other if they were going to. So we're just talking about 1-1. I'd like to follow up on this idea of it being a credibility issue. Not only was there not a specific credibility finding, but it's you don't have to decide that you don't believe the police officer. It isn't that type of a case. There's just not enough information on the record that there was that the execution of legal process was lawful. On the issue of lawfulness, we are asking you to interpret that element. We between us obviously don't agree what that means. As we look at the text of that subdivision, it says lawful execution of legal process. The legal process is the warrant, right? Legal means something, so presumably it means a valid warrant. The lawful means something in addition to that, and what we believe it means is in accordance with the law and not contrary to law. And so that's where you get to some of the other ideas that I talk about in my brief that I won't belabor here, but proof of an element such as lawful, requires more than the state presented in this case. We're hearing now on appeal about the only thing we've heard about it specifically, and that's counsel's information about what the CAD system may or may not give the officers. The counsel is saying that that system tells you that it's a lawful warrant or not, yet we have a police officer who testified in court that he didn't know anything about the basis of that warrant or it was whether it was lawful or not. And so we don't know that for sure.
But he did testify that he looked up the appellant's father, looked him up in the system, and that he saw in the system that he had a warrant. Is that correct?
Yes, and that's about pages 12 and 13 of the transcript is where this exchange is. And he said that he saw his name first on a list. He might have had a warrant, e-patrol or something, and then looked at his CAD system, and he was in that as well. Didn't give details about what else he knew from that.
So what else should we expect him to have done?
Well, I just say that when the prosecutor specifically asked if he verified the warrant, I think it was telling that the response was, just looked in my CAD system. To me, that check was a quick check, wasn't talking to dispatch, wasn't calling the jail, wasn't checking on statewide systems or some other way for what the basis of the warrant was. I mean, remember in his report, he doesn't say...
But it doesn't say that we have to know what the basis of the lawful execution is. It just says that it has to be lawful. So I guess I'm troubled by trying to figure out what more we would have expected the officer to do. If he sees it in the system, is he supposed to question whether it's valid?
And maybe this is more of a case of not, you know, the officer could choose to do what he did. But when you're the judge at a trial and determining whether there's enough evidence about whether the execution of the process is lawful, there needs to be more than something that was on this record. And in the most cases, the easiest way to prove it would be to put in the warrant itself, right? Talk about that at a minimum. And we're not, for the record, saying you have to rule that that happens in every single case. But as a practical matter, that is what happens in most cases where there is a document, where this type of thing, where you're proving the execution of a legal process. Let's take a hypothetical. If you have a police officer who's an order for protection case, you're not going to prove up that case without the order for protection in many situations, not all, I realize. And I realize there's discretion for the prosecutor in how they want to prove their case. But at the end of the day, we believe that you have to interpret the statute, you've got to decide what you think lawful is, and then when you apply it to the facts in this case, there's not enough there. If you apply the standard that the respondent is asking, there's not enough there either. And the piece that's most telling on that is that in his findings, finding six, the trial judge said or found that the child clearly interfered, right? And the standard is substantial interference. Clearly interfered and created a dangerous situation. And our position is that can all be true. As you look at that video and we think about our kids, we think, we don't want people doing this. But the focus has to be on the duties that the police were engaged with and then when the conduct occurred and whether the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that there was substantial interference with the specific duty that they elected to charge in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for the argument here today and for the briefing that was submitted. We certainly appreciate it. The case is submitted, and we'll issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you.